Welcome back to the Marlborough Book Festival podcast. Save the date for a winter weekend filled with engaging conversations and inspiring authors from the evening of July 25 through to Sunday, July 28. Discover what makes this festival a highlight for authors and readers alike at marlboroughbookfest.co.nz. For now, please enjoy this session from the 2023 Marlborough Book Festival.
Novelist, Pieces of You was her first book published back in 2017, was a finalist in the New Zealand Book Awards for Children and Young Adults, and the storyline's notable book. Since then, a stream of novels for adults and young adults have followed, and she has received huge critical praise, with one reviewer saying, Merriman is an instinctive storyteller with an innate sense of timing. So in addition to being a regular finalist in the New Zealand Book Awards for Children and Young Adults, Eileen has also been a finalist in the 2021 Nio Marsh Award for Best Crime Novel, and Moonlight Sonata was longlisted for the Jen Medlicott Acorn Prize for Fiction 2020. So as a foremost young adult writer, welcome here, Eileen. What actually, or who defines what young adult is? I mean, is it you yourself as the writer? Is it the publisher? Is it the sales staff, librarians, the reviewers, or the readers?
I think it's often all of those, So some of the books I write, I know, that this is young adult. That's my audience. Other times, I remember when I wrote a book, Trio of Sophies, I kind of thought it could be almost for adults, but it could be young adults too, and I wasn't sure. And I gave it to the publisher, and she said, oh, yeah, it's young adult. But I think it equally could have sold in the adult.
Well, I don't come into the category of young at all, and I love that.
Yeah, exactly. So
I love that book, Trio of Sophies. Yeah. So is there a young adult formula, though, that you have to write to or adhere to?
Only in that I try not to make the book too long, although I'm not really someone who writes hugely long books anyway, because I think it can be quite daunting, not to all teenagers, but some, to have a big, hefty novel. I try and keep the pace up a bit more, although, again, I quite like pace anyway. Try to keep the chapters a little bit shorter.
What about the material that you concentrate on? Is there a yes that can fall into it, and that's an absolute no-no?
Mostly I don't shy away from too much with the young adults, really. I mean, there are certain things you kind of think, no, that would be better in an adult novel, that would be better as an adult topic. To tell you specifically what that is, I'm not entirely sure, though, really, I've often written about things that are quite edgy.
You've touched on some very touchy subjects, suicide, homosexuality, family violence, rape, just insecurity and those sorts of things. Leukemia, dying as a young person. I mean, all of those things have come into it. And so you haven't shied away from anything.
No. Not specifically.
Now, as a young adult yourself, you excelled in science and English, which is pretty rare. I mean, that's left brain, right brain. I never know which is which, but both. So why did you decide to follow the science line and become a doctor rather than a writer?
Yeah. I mean, my natural subject actually always was English. That's, but I'd always been fascinated from a young age by medicine as well. And we'd go to one of my family friends' houses, and they had a book on how vaccines were discovered and Louis Pasteur, and he noticed that the milkmaids in the milk sheds, seemed to be immune to smallpox because they got cowpox. And I was just so fascinated by this. And I was so fascinated by the human body. And so when I was about 15, I said to my mother, oh, I want to be a psychologist. And she said, why don't you want to be a doctor? I said, I'm not brainy enough. And she said, you just need to try. So I went from a C+ in science to getting A's because I just put my head down and said, oh, actually, I do want to do this.
But you didn't do the psychology route?
No, I didn't in the end. I think I picked that because I thought, oh, I'm not brainy enough to be a doctor. But deep down, I wanted to be a doctor. Yep.
So you're a haematologist in North Shore Hospital. What does that actually entail?
So I look after people with blood diseases. So anything from anemia, leukemia, lymphomas. And I do a lot of the blood clots. So the thrombosis service, I run the thrombosis service. We get about 1,000 referrals a year. So I deal with inpatients and outpatients quite a lot. Little bit of lab. I don't do a huge amount of the lab, but it's really, really rewarding. And then for my sins, I run the department because no one else wanted to when the last person left. So I didn't run away fast enough.
You've probably been under even more pressure as a haematologist in the last 3 years because of COVID.
Yeah, it's been insanely busy. And the main problem is that there are not enough staff. And so a lot of people have started retiring early because of the pressure. And then you just get a vicious cycle that there's less and less staff, there's not enough junior staff, and so often we're just covering all the time for other people, and that's quite tiring.
Do you wish now you'd become a writer full-time?
Well, no, because I really love my job, yeah. I do love it, and I think it will get better in a few years. I think we're just in a bad cycle. I think the COVID pandemic just really has affected us, and it will affect us for 10 to 20 years probably.
Not just in medicine and
everywhere. But I think we just need to recover from that. And but I don't think I could be a writer full time because I need my the rest of my life to fuel my writing. And any time I've taken a whole day off to do writing, I don't actually write all day. It just never happens.
Well, we were just talking about this earlier and saying how wonderful things like this event, the festivals are for you write as writers to get together and share, because you don't get that opportunity. It's a very soul lonely thing to be a writer, I imagine, doing it all the time.
Yeah, and it's great once you make connections and you start to have writer friends, and every now and then you'll say, oh, let's go for a coffee, or and then 2 hours later you'll realise you're still chatting because you've got so much to say. You don't often get to have those kind of conversations.
Your very first book, you sent that to a publisher and got a rejection letter. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, a few books, actually. So,
were any of the books since been published?
Double Helix started off as Red Sky in the Morning, and it was quite different. I pulled it out one day, and I thought, these characters really want me to tell their story. I really need to get them out there. And in the end, I wrote 30,000 words of it, and I thought, oh, no, I just can't rewrite this. It's too hard. And I put it aside, and I wrote Violet Black. But then I pulled it out again. I just thought, oh, damn it, even if it's never going to be published, I just need to see this through. And then I sent it to my publisher, and I love that. Yeah. But it was, I had developed so much as a writer since my first time I tried to write that, and it was quite different.
When you got the rejection letter, did it put you off completely? Or
no, because I just knew I needed to keep trying and learning, and I just knew I had a lot to learn. So, and I did a couple of manuscript assessments with the New Zealand Society of Authors, and each time the comments... they got more and more. They got better. They got more and more encouraging. Yeah, you're nearly. You're nearly there. Yeah. In fact, the one before Pieces of You, they said, "Oh, yeah, try and get it out there," but it still didn't quite make it. Then once I started writing young adult, okay, good.
That's not meaning that it's easier to write young adult, because I imagine.
No, it's not. It's just I think I'd developed enough as a writer, and I found my voice, which I'd been writing books for people in their early 20s, and so I think the market, they were worried about the market not being quite there for that. So maybe that very last book I sent might have done all right, except, you know. And then when I wrote Pieces of You, it just got snapped up. Like, it just, you know. But I'd learnt a lot by then.
Do you think that writing has helped you in your role as a doctor?
Yeah, I think it does, because I consider people's stories, and I... definitely when I wrote Catch Me When You Fall, where the girl had leukemia, I worked in the bone marrow transplant unit in Christchurch, but I was on the other side of the bed. I was the doctor. And so I put myself in her shoes and her body, and I think it does help you. You know, every now and then I'll be consulting with the patient, and I'll think, sometimes they can get quite, you know, agitated or angry with you, and you think, okay, why are they angry? They're really, really stressed. You know, what's going on in their head? So I think it's helped me be more empathetic.
And to listen to them?
Yeah, like often I'll just put down my pen now. I don't write while they're talking to me, and I don't tap on my computer. I just sit there and let them just say their thing. And sometimes if they do come in and they're angry for some reason, you just sit there and let them spill it all out, and then by the end they're feeling better, you know?
A lot of your books do have a medical background. I mean, even the trilogy,
The Black Spiral. Yeah.
Black Spiral. Let's look. That's a trilogy now. And one of your books, a trio of Sophies.
Yeah.
James Bacon tells Sophie how to craft a story, and there's sort of like, there's the build up, there's the climax, and then the denouement.
Yeah.
So is that what a formula you adhere to as well?
Yeah. And I needed to learn that when I went to my writer's course, you know, after I got a couple more books rejected as an adult. And that was the first time I'd actually learnt that you build up to it. I guess I intuitively knew it, but I didn't know, it comes about this point in the book, etc. So, but I'm not a plotter. I'm not a very good plotter. So I'll say, okay, I've got a really strong character, and, I'll just start writing. But then I'll start to think, okay, well, I need to have some idea of what the climax is, but I don't know what's going to come in between. So I just work towards it.
And that's all very well in a single book, but how do you do it in a trilogy when you've got
the three books? Oh, that was quite hard, Well, because when I started writing Violet Black, all I had was a really strong character in my head. I didn't even have a plot. It was just because I like writing, and I get restless if I'm not writing. So I thought, I'll just start writing. And then I thought, oh, what's this all about? What's going to happen? So I had to think a lot about it. And then I realised it wasn't going to be one book because there was so much world building in there, and I didn't want to bring out this great big book to give to a teenager. So then I said to my son, who was maybe 12 at the time, do you think this should be a duology or a trilogy? He goes, well, trilogies are so much cooler. And I think he's right, actually. And then I put the question on Twitter because I follow lots of readers and writers on my Twitter feed. And I said, what do you think? Single book or a trilogy? Or what, you know, oh, trilogy. Most of them said we like a trilogy. We like the shape of a trilogy. And then I spoke to one of my writer friends. She said, no, you definitely need it to be a trilogy, you know. And she told me why she thought that should be. And so I went home and wrote book 2 in 7 weeks because I went, now I know what to do. That's why having conversations with other writers.
But then
great.
You finished the trilogy and decided to write a second trilogy to follow.
Well, it's a duology. That one is a duology. So I did write a trilogy, and then my publisher said, "What's going on with this third book? I don't understand." You know, and I said, "How about I amalgamate books 2 and 3 and shed a lot of that stuff that you didn't like?"
I was going to say, "What do you call 6 books?
Trilogy, like sextet or something. I don't know.
Mind boggles.
It's not quite as satisfying being a duology, but I think I didn't need all that extra stuff I had. So that one is a duology.
So was that hard to break it down to 2 from 3?
Yeah, it was quite challenging, but it was quite rewarding because I think I'd just gone a little bit off on a different track. And so, yeah, I had to rein it in. And because there's so much time travel in those 2 books, that was so really, really, really hard. Like playing around with timelines. Have they met each other yet in that time?
And then you went back into America, into a time frame that you had to actually...
I had to do some research for that. Yeah.
What kind of underwear did they wear and what were they eating?
Yeah. I was like, but it was fun. What did their houses look like?
You didn't have Twitter or anything like that to worry about.
Definitely not. Yeah.
So you talked just before about you did some writing courses, creative writing courses.
Yeah.
How did that help you?
So basically, I wrote from when I was about 8 till I was 18, and then I stopped. I went to uni. I was just busy studying. And then at the age of 36 or so, I got my first consultant job, and I suddenly thought, I need a hobby, because I was sitting so busy with studying and everything. And I started writing again, and I wrote this book that I thought everyone would love and that would sell so well, and it was about a junior doctor. And I sent it to Barbara Else for a manuscript assessment, and she sent it back, and halfway through she'd written, nothing is happening. And I was just like, oh. Okay, but I was okay. Well, and I'd always wanted to do a writing course, but I couldn't afford it when I was younger, and then I was just busy. So I thought, I'm going to do a writing course. So I did an introductory course, and then I did a 30-week night course. So every Thursday night, I'd run out of my clinic at 5 o'clock, and I'd have to swap my on call because they kept putting me on call on a Thursday, and do this 3-hour, and it was 32 weeks, and it helped me a lot because I was really good at dialogue and. Good at keeping the story moving. I didn't know anything about concrete markers and all that kind of thing.
What? Concrete markers?
Things like how to set the person in the scene, how to get them to visualise where that person is, how to evoke senses by just talking about, what do you smell when you're sitting in this room? What's the temperature? And just trying to have all that in your head and impart that. I didn't really know exactly how to do that. Maybe some of it I did, but I had never really sat down and thought about it.
Didn't know what to call it.
No, and even talking about the story arc and all those kind of things. Just, and when I look back now, it's natural now. I just do it, but I just didn't know enough.
So, what do you prefer, adult stories, young adult, or short stories?
To write. I don't know. I write a lot of young adult, and I find the voice really, really natural. But every now and then I'll just get a bit bored by it, and I'll think, I'm sick of writing, looking up NCEA, this and that, just for authenticity. And then I'll feel like writing an adult book, because I think you do get a bit more free rein in an adult book. I don't have to worry about someone might be upset by this and not want to sell it in schools or something like that, you know, that I can just, you can do whatever the hell you want with an adult book. But then I always feel myself going back to young adult, because I like it.
You, in your acknowledgements, you acknowledge your nieces.
Yep.
And all of them. How have they helped you with your writing?
Yeah, so Pieces of You, when they first had that book, Penguin said it had been a while since they'd published a book where they had to take a little bit of a risk because there was, you know, someone cutting themselves and this and that. And so they liked it, but they just wanted to pass it through some teenagers and things. So one of my nieces read it and gave some great feedback on that. And, you know, we just wanted to say, what do you think of the language, all that kind of thing. I was texting her. I was like, do teenagers still say French kissing? She went, what is that? I'm like, okay, that's my answer, you know. And often ask them about, and now it's quite good because I've got a teenager in the house, so I can ask him stuff and get some of his slang, which is just getting more and more outlandish. You're just like, I don't know, it's just I'm getting older. But not just my nieces, I've got some friends I go away with every year, and when I was writing Indigo Moon, I got some advice from a couple of the daughters on, one of them's in the audience here, Freya, just on what do you think about them shape-changing into moths? Because to me, I was like, I don't know if that's going to be boring. Oh, that's really cool, that's really cool. Because moths are really, really pretty, actually. I looked up moths for this book, because they were changing into animals. And my publisher said, oh, I don't know, you might want to get away from the trope of wolves and stuff, you know. What about moths? I was like, moths? I don't know. But when I looked them up, they were cool. And they gave me some great feedback.
Fact of the language that changes all the time. I mean, is your son quite sort of like, Mum, don't ever say that ever again?
Well, yeah, no, he's just like, oh, this is an old person thing. You know, he was saying Facebook is for old people, which I get. Now he's gone back on it. So, but just sometimes some of the things he says, I'll say, what does that mean? Mm. Like, oh, someone's flexing. What does that mean? Oh, they're showing off. Yeah, okay. And I just notice so many new phrases sneak into a speech now. And sometimes I just know what they are in context. And other times I go, and I think, oh, God, I'm getting old.
It's the acronyms that get me. I don't know.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. What acronyms. Does that mean? Yeah. I understand.
I remember reading somewhere that this, it was made up, I think, but it was this woman had sent news that an auntie had died, LOL, and the son said, laugh out loud. Yeah. She thought it was lots of love. The son had to say, well, no, you've just told everybody that Auntie Jones died, lots of laughs.
And you think it's hilarious.
Laugh out loud.
That's a common old person mistake. Mm.
I often wonder, though, because there's a lot of music appears, albums and that appear in your young adult books.
Yeah.
Do you get that from your children or from these?
Yeah, partly because I'll see what my son's listening to, and it's often surprising that they're often listening to older. I think shows like Stranger Things have brought back some of the old music, you know. So someone said to me, oh, would that teenager really be listening to Green Day? I said, my son loves Green Day. He's playing them on the guitar, you know, he wanted. I do get a lot of the music taste from him. Before he was a teenager, I would just kind of think, well, actually, teenagers listen to all sorts of things. And I'd sort of tune into the radio, what are they listening to? But sometimes I just think, well, they're listening to Fleetwood Mac and things like that still anyway, quite often.
He must be very proud of you, though, that you're writing these books and you're basically, you know, his peers are reading them.
Yeah, I think so. He doesn't usually read them. He read pieces of You. I think most of it went over his head because he was quite young then. And then he read A Trio of Sophies and he gave it a 4 on Goodreads out of 5. And I said, what did you give it a 4 for? And he goes, well, you know, I can't just give 5s. I just, you know, I think it was his policy not to give 5.
You've got to earn a 5, Mum.
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Well, it's a great book, Trio of Sophies. Now, Silence of Snow is probably one of my top reads this year. And the reviewer in the spin-off said, I could pick Eileen Merriman's writing anywhere, especially the way she's been writing lately. She has struck on a particular minor key that rings across every page, clear and sharp and quick. It makes you want to listen close. It makes you uncomfortable. I totally agree with that. Silence of Snow made me very uncomfortable. Mm. And I mean, that night after I'd started reading it, do you remember, I don't know if anyone does, but remember the song, Mama, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys?
No, I don't know
that song. Very old song. Yeah. Well, I had an earworm that night was, Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be doctors. Because because the start of the book was just quite horrendous for me. Now, it's a first year medical student and an anaesthetist.
Yeah.
And it's set in Nelson, where you actually did a year.
2 years, yeah.
2 years.
Yeah.
So is this slightly autobiographical?
Not the drug taking bit, but in terms of the sheer horror of being thrust into a job as a first year junior doctor, and you, no matter what you do, you can't really be fully prepared. And I just remember my first night shift. I was the only doctor in the whole hospital. I was manning ED, surgical wards, medical wards, and just thinking, oh my goodness, you know. I mean, you could call the senior doctors all the time, of course. But you didn't want to wake them up all the time. You know?
I mean, it terrified me thinking that if I need to go to the hospital in the middle of the night, I want to know that the person who I'm dealing with is awake, has not been up for the last 5 days without any sleep.
Yeah, no, and generally, well, the condition's lots better now, so which is quite good. When we did night shift, we'd do 7 nights in a row, and I found that quite hard. But you would go and sleep during the day, right, and then you'd come on, it'll be 11, and then you'd work till 8, and then you go home again. But in the older days, And sometimes still in the UK, they'd be up for 72 hours and things. That's just wrong. It's just, you know. So it has got his better than that, but it's still a stressful, hard time to go through, yeah.
So you worked in Nelson,
yeah,
in Christchurch,
yeah,
and now you're on the North Shore.
Yeah, and I had a year in Melbourne before I came to the North Shore, yeah.
Anything else now that you've done all of that that you wish you had done?
In terms of medicine?
Yeah.
I think I'm quite happy with what I did. When I went to Monash, I was a research fellow and I was specialising in the clotty sort of stuff. And I did think about doing a PhD at that stage, but we'd had one child and we were quite keen to have another one. I thought, oh, my husband said, I'm quite keen to just settle down now. And I said, yeah, no, that's fair enough. So we came back to the North Shore, but then I did the PhD part-time, like, because it was a clinical trial. So I managed to get my PhD.
Where on earth do you find time to write then?
Yeah, no, so at that stage I was editing The Silence of Snow and trying to work on the PhD, and I was in Dublin and out on a conference, and it was 5 a.m. and I was trying to work on the PhD, and I was, you know, doing that, and then I rang my husband. No, I messaged him. I said, can you FaceTime now? He goes, no, I'm in hospital. I was like, oh my God. And so he'd broken his arm in Thailand. We'd been in Thailand and I'd gone on to Dublin, and he'd fallen and he'd hit his arm. And I said to him, you need to get an x-ray. Oh, no, it's fine. It's just a hematoma. I Googled it. And I was like, okay, but you might...
I'm a hematologist. I might know this.
And you might want to get an x-ray when you... Sorry, off the topic here. But you might want to get an x-ray when you go home, you know. And he goes, oh, yeah. But, yeah, you had to get a plate in. But anyway, yeah, that was quite a time when I probably got less sleep. Yeah.
You know. And what, he'd broken it?
Yeah, he had a plate inserted. You know, he walked around all holiday with his arm, and apparently the hematoma was splinting it. So there was a period when it wasn't actually that sore. But just before I flew to Dublin, he didn't tell me it had got quite sore, and he flew home with our two kids. And then he drove himself to hospital. And I said, shall I come home? And he said, oh, no, don't worry about it. The worst will be over in the next 24 hours, and all the neighbours are bringing me dinners and stuff, and your dad's taking the kids.
He probably is thinking this is actually quite good.
Yeah, I said, oh, I didn't want to ruin the holiday. Okay. You know.
Yeah. So you've got a 12-year-old son.
And no, he's 15.
And yeah. And a daughter as well.
Nine-year-old daughter, yeah.
So that's yeah. Fairly full-on. So,
yeah.
You know, with your job, your day job,
yeah.
When are you writing?
So luckily my husband runs the household, so he's a stay-at-home husband. He just does a bit of property management. So we have dinner quite early in our house. It's often about 5:30, and then about 6, the shoulders sit in the armchair in the lounge, and they might be watching The Chase or something like that, and I'll just maybe write for an hour. I'm often quite tired these days. And then on the weekend, often after lunch is a good time. I'll just sit down with a cup of coffee, and if it's summer, I'll sit outside on the outside couch and maybe write for an hour, maybe a little bit longer.
Do you handwrite or do you type?
No, type, usually. Sometimes when I'm desperate, if I'm on holiday, I might write on my phone. And it, you know, and then wow. Just,
single
but, you
finger,
know, if I think,
yeah.
I don't want to bring out my laptop, that's a bit unsociable. And I love writing on the plane. So if I do a long distance trip, I will go hours of uninterrupted time, you know, which is great for editing too. If you're shifting, you need hours to get absorbed in something.
So yeah. When you're talking about editing, you've written a book, you've sent it to the publisher, and they send it back to you to do a sub edit, do they?
Yeah, that's usually not quite so bad. It's probably more when I'm doing it myself. But sometimes, like when I wrote Moonlight Sonata, my first adult book, she wanted a semi-major revision of that. So that was, you know, kind of quite challenging trying to. And that's when you need to sit down and really concentrate. Because if I'm just writing and it's coming out for the first time, it doesn't matter if I'm sitting in the lounge with the TV on and stuff. But if I'm doing something quite major like that, then I quite need some time alone, really. Yeah. But I need to do most of my writing with people around because I don't have time.
So you'd get a couple of hours in a day?
Not that much anymore. Probably less than that now. Probably maybe an hour or something like that at the most. Yeah.
It's not a lot. You're prolific.
Yeah, I used to write a lot more probably, maybe it probably was 2 hours a day. Yeah, I sort of eased off a little bit because the publisher was a bit like, slow down. So, you know, well, not that I need to, you know, if I'd want to keep writing, I will, but the next adult book's coming out next year, so they've already got the publishing lineup. So, yeah.
What's your favourite book that you've written?
Probably Silence of Snow and A Trio of Sophies, I would think. And Catch Me When You Fall. Sorry, I've given you three. Probably The Silence of Snow, I think.
That's a great book. Yeah. What about your favourite book to read?
To read? Oh, there's a few. I loved Martin Amis. I really like his. He wrote Time's Arrow, which is the first properly backwards book I've ever read. Even the rain went upwards and stuff. And if you read the book, it's quite a short book, actually. You'll read why he's used that device. And people will walk out of doctors' rooms more distressed than when they went in, for instance, and all that thing. But then it goes right back to World War II, so it all gets a bit creepy. But I love all sorts of writers. I like, I'm really enjoying Catherine Chidgey's writing. You know, I like a lot of our New Zealand writers. They're just amazing. I really like Tim Winton, an Australian writer, because he really, you feel like you're in Western Australia. I love it when writers do that and just get you totally immersed.
We were talking about this a little earlier. New Zealand writing has really come of age in the last 10 years, I'd say.
Yeah.
Is that because of events like this, do you think?
I think that really helps. And I'll come to these events and I'll pick up the books and I'll take them home and read them. I think these are really, really, really good books, you know. And then this year I thought, I am going to read every shortlisted book on the fiction for the Ockhams, you know, so that's four. I liked every single book, and I thought, we're so lucky, you know. And then the more I read, the more I want to read. I sort of think, well, I better read their other books then, you know. And we really punch above our weight, I guess.
Do you do the same with things like the Booker?
Yeah, I don't read them every single year. No, I don't. I mean, I do pick them up and read them, but not the whole shortlist.
I like that idea, though, reading everyone.
Well, it's quite fun to set myself that task. Mm. Yeah, I was like, oh, I have to try and read them before the Writers' Festival. I didn't manage to finish the last one, but I nearly got there.
Yeah. Going back to the trilogy and the duology, Black Spiral and Eternity Loop, they deal with a pandemic of measles which infects and basically creates an infertile world.
Yeah.
Did you write that during the pandemic?
No. So I started writing Violet Black, the original one, in 2019. So it was a whole year before, but there'd been the measles epidemic and so lots of kids died in Samoa and you know, it was quite bad here as well, I think. And then I sort of thought, well, what if the vaccine stopped working very well? You know, what if vaccination rates fell and the measles virus mutated and it became really, really even more awful than it is? And then lots of people got inflammation in the brain and died, but of the ones who survived, what if that allowed them to have a collective consciousness, you know? Because I wanted to make it kind of almost plausible. And then just keep pushing that boundary. Just, okay, but then maybe what if they start doing this? And then what if they start doing this? And that was really fun, like a science fiction-y thing. And I set it about 20 years in the future. And I was having conversations with my husband about, so do you think what kind of power for the cars? And we're talking about fusion cars and how they'll have a little trail of water behind them, wouldn't they? Because that's the byproduct. And, you know, so and then I'd make things up and then realise they'd already been invented, you know. But, yeah, so... Yeah, and then the infertility, that came later. That was in the other two books, the duology.
I suppose that's the lovely thing with medicine. You can explore in lots of different ways.
Yeah, that's where having the medical background really helps for that kind of stuff because you have that in-depth understanding. You can go, well, that's not plausible. That wouldn't be plausible, but that one could be. And how do I explain the fact these characters are not aging? Oh, let's mess with their telomeres or something like that, you know. That's quite fun.
Do you get much response from young people regarding your books, particularly some of the ones that were the subjects we've talked about, like the cutting and suicidal thoughts?
I get lots of response. They're so good, actually. They'll might message me on Instagram or something and say, I just love your books, or come up to me after book festivals. The one I wrote, Invisibly Breathing, about the two boys who fall in love with each other, a girl came up to me after one and said, are you going to write more like that? Because there's just not enough like that written by Kiwis, you know. And I said, well, probably not because I'm straight, so that was probably a one-off for me. But, you've totally described my experience with the cutting, or I felt like you wrote this book for me. And that's always such a compliment, you know.
What a pleasure to receive. Yeah,
really.
Must inspire you to carry on writing.
Yeah, because I think, well, because I read quite a few books and you'd think, oh, they're American books, you know, YA and Squeaky Clean Family and this and that. I mean, they're probably a bit different now quite often. But I just feel like they're not all families are like that, you know. The families are going through breakups and this and that. And so I just wanted to mirror real-world problems in the books.
Yeah. When you were young, did you read a lot yourself?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Yeah.
What did you read? Did you read adult or young adult?
Yep. I mean, there wasn't as many that were classified as young adult then. But I would read... I read a lot of J.D. Salinger. Once I read The Catcher in the Rye, I thought I need to read them all. But I was reading Sylvia Plath and J.K. Baxter and lots of novels, anything I could find in my parents' bookshelf, you know, and then Clan of the Cave Bear, all that series as well, and psychological thrillers. Stephen King, I loved Stephen King. I still think he's amazing, but I like his earlier work. Mm. But I would love especially his more psychological thriller ones.
If you could interview one or spend time with one author that's no longer present, who would it be?
That's no longer present. Probably Cormac McCarthy.
And why?
He's
sorry, Cormac McCarthy.
You know, he wrote The Road, and he only very recently died in Blood Meridian, and recently wrote Stella Maris and those books. And his writing is just, I don't even know how to describe it. He sets you in the place. His dialogue is so amazing that he could write pages and pages of dialogues, which he did for his whole last book, was all dialogue, and you know exactly who's speaking. You know, that's such a skill, because that means he's really got, and it's just beautiful and evocative, and he stirs your emotions. He rips your heart out, basically. He just, but he's got everything that a good writer should have, and he's very, very intelligent. I think he was made an honorary professor of a university or something, and he spent a lot of time with physicists and people. And
what's next? You've got a book, an adult book that's coming out next year.
Yeah, so it's called The Catalyst, and it's set in student-filled Dunedin, and it starts with a girl falling to her death from a window, and then you've got to work out.
Sounds like a Russian spy novel.
Almost. So then you go back to the start of the year, and there's all these people in your side, and we're like, what happened? What happened? Did she kill herself? Did someone kill her? What, you know? That was so much fun to write. And
taking you back to your Scarfy days?
Yeah, it was taking me back to my Scarfy days. So I pictured my flat, and then I had to modernise it as well, and then various bits. I've got this detective friend who I went to school with, and I always call on him, you know. And one day I message him. He goes, "Oh yeah, I've got the sniffer dog guy's number if you want to call him." I was like, "Oh no, that's okay. I think you've given me enough information, you know." But you know, I mean, and then you know, because I've got medical contacts, and got in contact with a friends at pathologists just about, how much would you be able to tell from the cause of death for various reasons that I needed, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but she was really helpful, and so that was.
What about your book? Some of your books have been picked up in other countries.
Yeah.
Yep. Has Penguin, who are your publishers, have they helped you with that?
Yeah, so they, so a trio of Sophies went to Germany, so there were two German publishers vying for it, and they were quite cute. They sent PowerPoint presentations. They were very German. Like, you know, why you would want to come with us, you know. And so that's been translated into German and gone over there. Pieces of You was Turkish for some reason. Some of them have audiobook rights, like The Silence of Snow and Moonlight Sonata and Black Spiral Trilogy, so that's international audio rights quite often for them. But they've all gone through Penguin.
We talked earlier too about having an agent. You said you had an agent for your first book. What does an agent do for a writer?
Yeah, it's really good when you're starting out, because if you can get an agent to pick you up, they've basically already vetted your material and said, okay, well, I think you're good enough that you're publishable, and I'm going to send your material to the publisher. So then you sort of brings you to the top of that slush pile, you know. Because the publisher will go, okay, well, if such and such has sent it to me, it must be worth looking at. So that can help speed up the process. Otherwise, you can wait months for people to read your manuscripts. But when I got my agent, she sent it out to four publishers and said, get back to me in 4 weeks. And I was like, whoa. And they did.
So you still have an agent?
Not anymore, I have such a good relationship with Penguin that I thought, you do have to pay your agent. Obviously, you have to pay your agent. I mean, you know. And I thought, at the moment, I feel like I know enough about my book contracts and the book industry to just go it by myself. And that may not always be the case. It just totally depends what's happening. If you get a big international deal, maybe an agent's a good idea.
What about if somebody wanted to pick up the movie rights?
Yeah, but they do that. They've done that anyway. I've got movie rights option for Catch Me When You Fall and Pieces of You in Australia, which was through Penguin. And then the Black Spiral Trilogy actually went through my agent, but otherwise they go through Penguin anyway.
So they've got movie rights?
For some of those,
When will we see those?
It's like the 7-year hell thing, like, what do they call it? The developmental hell stage at the moment. So about 20% of all books that are optioned will actually make it to the screen. But they're all working on scripts, and they do get in contact. They've all been renewed this year, so they, you know, every year they pay you a small sum of money. You don't really get anything till it starts being filmed. Much.
How do you feel about that? Somebody taking your work and taking their own perspective on it.
I like it. And I've zoomed different script writers about those two first young adult books, and I really like their suggestions. You know. And they're not huge. They're not hugely changing the story. But sometimes I go, I think this might work better. And I go, that's a good idea. I like that.
So you're involved in the process all the way through?
I mean, they'll touch base with me. They touch base with me. They'll say, oh, I need to get more into Jamie's head more. This was for Catch Me When You Fall. And I went, oh, that's cool, because I've just finished the manuscript for Catch a Falling Star, which is the prequel. And so had a big Zoom chat about them so they could understand him a bit better. So that was quite cool.
Can we maybe, now's a good time to do a reading from Catch a Falling, which is your latest book that's came out this year.
Actually, I made a mistake. It's not Pieces of You that's optioned. It's Invisibly Breathing. And Catch. Okay, so the background to this is in Catch Me When You Fall, there's a girl, Alex, who's got leukemia. She's relapsed leukemia, and she's 17. And on the day she finds out she's relapsed, she meets this guy in the lab test waiting room. They're both getting blood tests. And you don't learn why he's getting that blood test for a while. But as it turns out, he's got his own medical issues, and he's got bipolar affective disorder or manic depression. So and I wrote one chapter in there from his point of view, and I thought, actually, I want his backstory. So I decided to write his backstory. So at the start of this book, it's a couple of years before, and he's 15, and his brain's going a million miles an hour, and he's in love with his best friend's girlfriend. So he's a little bit chaotic. And he's just been allocated a book to read and do an essay on for English. 1984 has 342 pages. I started reading the book in last period, which was maths. I figured that actors and lawyers, both of which I was interested in becoming, didn't need to be caught at maths, especially when it involved obscure equations with X's and Y's flying about all over the place. That got me through the first four chapters, where I learned the main character, Winston, worked for a place called the Ministry of Truth, which basically had nothing to do with the truth at all. What could I call that in my essay? Satire? Irony? Seemed like something most politicians did all the time. Lying, I mean. When I got home, I got a Coke out of the fridge and took it to my room, where I lounged on the window seat with Pavlova draped artfully over my knees. I say artfully because he's very vain. Kristen said that was who she'd miss the most when she went away, the cat. I dived into chapter 5, which was all about newspeak and education and thought criminals, and I got to thinking about what would happen if people could hear my thoughts. That got me thinking about my musical, where Billy Raven could hear everyone's thoughts once he became a time vampire. Before I knew it, I was downstairs composing a vampire song on the piano. That is until Mum arrived home from work and I realised it was 6 p.m, damn it. How was school? Mum poured herself a glass of wine. She had one after work every day, said it helped her relax. It was good, I said. We're reading 1984. Oh, what's that about? Big brother and the thought police. Got to go, work to do. I bounded up the stairs, this time heading for the study so I could be influenced by all the books around me. Our study has floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, which Mum had installed soon after my parents bought the house. She said it was an essential feature for a librarian. My father said it was really an excuse to buy more books. By the time Mum called me for dinner, I'd read three more chapters, which was most of part one. What are you studying? Mum asked once we were seated at the table. English. Jamie, don't talk with your mouth full. I swallowed hard, scowled at her. You asked me a question. Mum sighed and massaged her forehead. Have you talked to your dad lately? No, have you? Mum gave me a look. Next would be a speech in Norwegian, I just knew it. I spoke to him last week, I said. He and Guy are going on holiday to Vanuatu next month. I ate the rest of my dinner so fast it felt as though there were rocks in my esophagus, as Vaughan liked to call it, and got told off by Mum for leaving the table before she finished her meal. You don't know how much pressure I'm under, I yelled from the kitchen, scrubbing a pot. But if I fail my exams, I'll say, don't worry, I have impeccable table manners. Enough, Mum said in Norwegian, so I gave up and crooned to myself instead. In my imagination, I was a Billy Raven phantom hybrid, a time vampire with a half-face mask to hide the acid-ravaged part of my skin. I was singing Close Every Door, which is actually from Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, but the lyrics about shutting out the light were perfect for a vampire. Once I returned to the study, I wished I was a time vampire, because reading 1984 was going to take longer than I thought. I made a promise, though, if only to myself, and I'm stubborn like that. So I kept reading until I got to the very last line, and it was very, very ironic. But I can't reveal what it is, because that would ruin the whole book. When I finally crawled into bed, it was 3:30 in the morning.
The very last line. The very last line you said there, and I know that you believe that the very first line of any book is the most important.
Absolutely.
Why?
Because you just need to get it right. You want to get the person reading, you know. I love first lines. I often do that as an exercise, and if I'm taking workshops for school and things.
What makes a good first line?
Something that's different, that stands out, that makes you want to read on. It makes you wonder, you know.
Can we read the first line, please, from Silence of Snow?
Yeah. Silence of Snow.
Not putting you under any pressure.
No, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Okay. There was no peace, even in the loo.
Yep, no peace. Which conjures up an image any mother wouldn't understand.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
So is that the hardest line to write in the entire book then?
Not necessarily. I don't know why. It's quite exciting to write the first line and just kind
of. But because you place so much importance on it, yeah. I just wonder if it makes it more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it does. I mean, it does. Like, I sit there and I spend a long time thinking about the character's name before I even start writing. And I even think of the chapter of the book, which I'll usually change at some point. But I feel like I have to do that before I even put my pen on the page. And I'm thinking a lot about the character. So by the time I write that first line, I've thought quite a lot.
Do you have a mind plot, you know, sort of sitting in front of you that you're looking up at to remind you where you should be going?
No, I have a calendar. So I will, and I'll say, okay, today is blah, blah day. Because I've got into muck-ups before where I've got the months and the weeks out of order and stuff. So usually I'll have that, but I don't really plot. I'm not very good at plotting. So I just kind of had a vague idea that if I'm up to 30,000 words, yep, cool. If I get up to about 60,000 words in an adult book, I need to start going towards the climax. So I'll know when I'm starting to get closer to that bit that I need to start getting, you know, ramping it up a bit more. Yeah. But I need to build on what I wrote before. And so every time I've tried to plot it out, I just inhibit myself and think, I can't do this. I'm never going to be able to do this.
Charity Norman had an interesting way of she used to cut out pictures from magazines of what she thought her characters would look like. Yep. And she had a board in front of her so she could look at them all
I've done
the time.
That before. Like I've looked up pictures and gone, oh, yeah, they look a bit like that actor. And so I do have a picture in my head for my characters. It is nice to. And I steal people's houses. Like I can't. Otherwise, I get all the dimensions wrong, and suddenly the person should have been downstairs, and actually now their room's upstairs. And so, in my head, I'll think of someone's house I know, and I'll use that house. So my mother-in-law was really excited when I used her house for Double Helix, and she kept saying, "When's that book coming out? When's it coming out?" You know? Yep.
What other sort of tips have you got for anybody who may be interested in writing?
Basically, just to keep practicing, read a lot, and when you read, have a think about why you think they've done well, why do you like this book, and how do they build the pace, and how do they do their characters, and or if you didn't like it, why didn't you like it? But then just keep practicing, because no one ever got anywhere without practicing. And if I look back at my earlier stuff, you know, not amazing, but if you keep practicing and keep trying, and if you're being rejected, just can learn from it. Like, just
can you ever see the day that you will be a full-time writer?
I think I'll have to be like retired from my day job. Yeah. And so I need to pay off my mortgage.
Is it not a profitable business to be a writer in New Zealand?
No. So probably I have written that many books, and my annual salary might be $15,000 a year or something like that. From that. Yeah. Something like that. It's not huge.
It's not huge, is it?
No.
Who makes all the money then? Is it the booksellers?
Well, I guess the thing is it's also volume. So if you publish in the US and you get on their bestseller list, then there's a lot more people in the US, so you're going to sell a lot more books. Whereas here, even if I get on the bestseller list, you know, I might sell 2,000-ish books. I mean, different if you're maybe Catherine Chidgey, she sells a lot more probably, but she's also selling overseas and things like that. So, we're just a much smaller market. It's just harder, you know, and I don't think my publisher's necessarily making gigantic amounts of money.
But it just seems for all that hard work that you're putting in, it seems very little return.
Yeah. I mean, luckily I've got a day job, so I don't have to rely on it. Mm. So I still love what I do, and I'm not doing it for the money. But if I want to become a full-time writer, then I have to get more serious about that bit and go, well, how am I going to get my book into the US? And basically the answer is, apparently, which I don't like, is, well, don't set your book in New Zealand. Don't like that. But
don't set your book in New Zealand.
They don't like, you know, so the biggest market's the US, and most of them don't want to read books set outside of the US, which is like, really?
Well, we've spent all of our lives reading books in other places.
But New Zealanders are so different. We're so different. Like, we look out because we live in a small country, and we travel, and we, you know. And that's not necessarily true, because some of our New Zealand writers who set books in New Zealand do go overseas, but it's not that common. And then a lot of the ones who set them overseas, then they do. Yeah. So I don't know. Is that my end goal? Not really. I just love writing anyway. So, but it would be nice one day to say, well, that book's now gone to the US and the UK. And
anything you'd really like to write about that you haven't yet?
I really enjoy psychological thrillers, but I think that's the next one coming out. Probably at some stage, maybe a memoir, but I think you should be quite brave to write a memoir. Mm. But I would like to one day, because there's a lot of stuff that's happened in my life that I think I would like to show to other people, to say, that you can get through stuff and resilience and lots of mental health issues in my family and all sorts of things, you know, that I think it's nice for people to tell their stories. I like reading people's memoirs about their troubled times and going, oh, that's cool that you've been so honest. Mm. But I don't feel ready to do that yet.
You're a bit young to do that, I think.
So, yeah. Well, there's been a lot of things. But, yeah, no, I think that's more of a late career thing that you do. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure there are some questions from the audience. Now, we do have a microphone, I believe. Yes, Charlotte's got a mic too, actually. Mm-hmm. Now, we do ask that if you are going to ask a question, you use the microphone simply so everyone can hear it, but also because we're recording for a podcast. So, Julie.
I have a teenage son who's lent me your non-science fantasy books. He always read that, and I started buying him your books to get him to change topic. They are very topical. He loved them. He's lent them to his friends. But I just finished reading Moonlight Sonata, and I'm not sure how many people have read it.
Yeah.
I was reading it thinking, I feel a bit uncomfortable reading this book, but your writing compelled me to continue reading it to the end.
Yep.
How do you write about a topic like that without making the reader feel really ick, for want of a better word? It's just so well written. You feel uncomfortable. You're like, oh, I'm not sure. But you go right to the end because you're just dragged in and you want to know.
So basically there's incest in Moonlight Sonata. And I think originally when I wrote a short story first, and that was placed in the Sunday Star Times, and then I think I was trying to write a really different story. I was thinking, what can I write about that people usually don't like writing about, that will stand out, but try and keep it quite subtle until until quite late you don't actually know what's going on at all.
You get the idea of, I think I know where this is headed, but you're not sure.
But I'm not quite sure,
Then it goes from the brother and sister to the cousin, so it's sort of generational.
A mirroring thing, And I just kind of thought, well, how do these, because these things do happen, so how do they happen and what's the background to that? And I like shades of grey, you know, like you can be very black and white and say, well, naturally that's wrong, and why is that wrong? Well, it's wrong. And yes, you know. But how does it happen? And there's people behind that. And why, you know? So it was just something I was interested in exploring. And
it must be quite satisfying, though, that regardless of what the emotion is that you engender, you at least are creating an emotion.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting an impact from it.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Yes. Stop the back there. Joe? Oh.
Eileen, I found your piece yesterday very compelling. And dark and visceral.
Yeah.
Who? Oh, sorry. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Whose voice do you write with? Is it the characters? Is it yours?
Yeah. Do you mean for that piece or?
For that piece and for other pieces.
Yeah.
For that piece and for other pieces.
So that piece was fiction, but it was creative nonfiction. So there was a lot in there that wasn't true, but there was stuff in there that was true, which is that I felt like an alien in my first year. But not all of those events happened, like the sexual assault didn't happen. But there was a lot of truth in there. But often in the books that I'm writing, there is a bit of me in every book. But then I'll amplify out some part of myself and then take it somewhere else, you know. So that I think that's how you get your authenticity, because you're actually feeling the emotions of the characters. You're like, well, I can do this. But there's stuff in my books that I've not done. I've not taken drugs. I've not cut myself, all that kind of thing. So I do have to do a bit of a background kind of thing. And when you create a character, they do take on a voice. In each book, they're different. They're different voices. You'll find they are different people. And I'm always thinking about who they are and what their background is, etc. So, a little bit of me in every character.
You have to have a super ego to be a writer, you know, to place yourself in books like this?
Ego,
ultra ego?
No, most writers have not a lot huge ego. I mean, there is a few, but most of us are quite shy and introverts.
Because it feels like you do have to put yourself out there in some ways.
Yeah.
Particularly when you're talking about subjects that are very close to you as a person, like in Silence of Snow.
But that's why I use the third person, I think, for those ones, because I don't want people to think that that's me. Because, you know, I have drawn on medical experiences, but those characters are completely, they're not me. And so I don't, and especially when I'm writing the medical field where my colleagues might be reading it, and I really don't want them to think, oh, this is a... And well, no one has ever said that. No.
You actually, yeah. after the Silence of Snow, you actually read part of that at a medical conference for senior doctors.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Because I think, actually, I published it, and one of them, he's in a, you know, training to be an anaesthetist, you know, and actually the College of Anaesthetists, like their communication person rang me up one day, thought, am I in trouble? You know, and but she said, oh no, we thought it might touch a nerve because there'd been a couple of deaths amongst anaesthetists due to drug incidents. And she said, but they like it. They really want to read it and talk about it. And then the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, that's our union, they have an annual conference. And they said, oh, we quite like to put in something about something you're doing outside of medicine, but can you come and read from your book? And in the same session was Glenn Calcahoon and Renee Liang, who are both doctor writers as well.
You were going to read something from The Silence of Snow. Is this the part that you read to the conference?
Yes, it is. So basically... this is the so Rory, he is 29 going on 30, and the other character is Jody, who's a first year junior doctor. But he's been a doctor for quite a while, but he's travelled to Nelson from Wellington, where an incident has happened and it's haunting him. And this is him remembering this. So he's anaesthetising a 13-year-old. The first half of the operation went to plan. Oh, and the other background, he's just done a whole series of nights and he's been asked to stay behind in the morning because the other anaesthetist can't make it. So he's already been up all night and it's 8 a.m. The first half of the operation went to plan. Rory put the girl to sleep, slipped a laryngeal mask down her throat and hooked her up to the gas that would keep her under for as long as the surgeon needed to operate. The beep, beep, beep of the machine tracking Taylor Newman's heartbeat was soothing. So soothing, Rory felt his vision grey a couple of times. Don't fall asleep, just don't. You all right there? The anaesthetic tech asked. Yeah. Rory pinched the tops of his thighs, blinked. It's been a long night. A line from a favourite poem popped into his head, one about having a mile to go before he slept. Actually, it would probably be an hour and a half, give or take, before he'd get to sleep, by the time he drove home and gobbled down some breakfast. As soon as he thought of food, his mouth began to water. When had he last eaten? He didn't think he'd had much more than a bottle of yoghurt since dinner the night before. Rory never felt like eating much on night shift, but now he was starving. He pinched his thighs again, checked the girl's observations, pulse, blood pressure, oxygen. Oh, but I just want to go to bed. The surgeon's voice seemed as though it were coming from far off. Farewell, tonsils, Donnie said. Rory jerked to attention. Okie dokie. God, how long had he zoned out for? Surely it was only seconds. He began to lighten the anaesthetic, bringing the girl back from La La Land. Oh, to be coasting on a cloud of sevoflurane. A couple of minutes later, the beeping, which had been slow and steady throughout, sped up. Rory's eyes strayed towards the machine. The girl's pulse rate had jumped from 82 to 105. What? That was when he saw the falling oxygen level, the flatline shape of the carbon dioxide trace. Shite. Rory whipped his stethoscope off the bench and slapped the diaphragm over the kid's chest. Silence, no air moving at all. Laryngospasm, it had to be. The vocal cords are clamped shut, so nothing could move in or out. The girl must have blood on her vocal cords, or maybe she'd regurgitated her stomach contents into her throat. Damn it, damn it. Donnie Yang's voice intruded into his consciousness. Everything all right there? Can you step away for a sec? Rory dialed the oxygen up and started ventilating the girl using a bag and mask. What do you mean, step away? Yang looked indignant. I'm nearly done here. Exactly what I said. Rory's voice was tight. I'm trying to manage a laryngospasm. Can you stop poking and prodding her? He nodded at the anaesthetic tech. Can you dial up the gas? Rory went through all the steps he'd been taught as a junior registrar. Check the airway for blood. Deepen the anaesthesia. Muscle relaxant. Give 100% oxygen. The oxygen level came up. The carbon dioxide trace normalised. Rory secured Taylor Newman's airway with another tube, which went down with no hassle. Thank fuck. He gave Donnie permission to touch Taylor again, and the surgeon finished sewing the girl up. Rory dared to think of sleep again, even though he was now feeling very, very awake. It was when he's taken the second tube out of the girl's throat that he saw the blood. Not a lot, just a trace of foamy bubbles on the end of the tube. But the girl seemed fine, apart from a marginally low oxygen level. Well, the blood was no surprise. Tonsillectomies were always a bloody business. Either that or Rory had scraped something on the way down. It had been a while since he'd had to manage a laryngospasm, but he'd done all right. Not just all right, he'd managed it perfectly. Rory was wheeling the girl to recovery when his phone rang. Simon, thank goodness, just in time for the second case. Rory went home and slept like a dead person. He didn't learn about the cardiac arrest until the following evening, about the post-obstructive fluid on the lungs that Rory should have, but hadn't picked up on. It took Taylor Newman 2 days to die. Rory had been dying a slow death ever since.
And we have another question.
Eileen, yep. I was intrigued that you chose Cormac McCarthy as the person you'd like to speak to the most.
Yep.
And I just wondered if I could ask you a question, given the fact that Oppenheimer is just about to open in the movies, and you talked about him as a writer. But if you were going to talk to him about his subject or what he writes about or the worlds he inhabits, because one of your themes has been that you write about worlds that aren't you and that people who aren't you, but in his novels it's mostly men and men who are incredibly violent. And of course, Oppenheimer comes into that with the Manhattan Project and all the rest. Would you talk a bit more, what would you ask Cormac McCarthy about, or why does that subject matter interest you?
A lot of the earlier books, yes, they are incredibly violent. You know, the Western, or a lot of them were set in Mexico, etc. I think the first book I came across, though, was The Road, which was quite dystopian, and that really struck me. And just often he can have a sparsity of writing, but there's a lot there. You know, he doesn't need to put much on the page to evoke a lot. And then the book, I'm trying to remember the name of it, The Passenger, before Stella Maris, I don't think that was that violent. And there's a lot of science in there. And you can tell he's thought a lot about that and put a lot of that into it. So that was quite interesting to me. The other thing he often does is he doesn't give us much access to the character's thoughts, but somehow he just pulls you along. So usually you say, you need access to their thoughts to get empathy, etc. But somehow he manages to do that in a completely different way. And so it just really interests me that he's a very different writer, and you can spot his writing. You know, if someone gave me a blind passage and I read it, I'd probably go, I think I know who this is because of the way he writes. Yeah. That may not have answered your question necessarily, but I think he ended up doing quite a diverse, it was just the initial ones were all, as you say, there was a lot of violence. But then I would also think this is interesting historical stuff too about what actually may sort of happened back then. Yeah.
Yeah, but the passages begin with a girl hanging in a tree who's just killed herself.
Yeah, yeah.
And the violence of America is all the way through it.
Yes, yeah, no, that's right. But that's there, isn't it? It's life, you know? Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming out on this very cold Saturday morning to listen to Eileen. You've been an absolute pleasure to talk to.
Thank you very much.
A round of applause. Enjoy the rest of your stay here in Marlborough. And thank you for coming down. I hope you get some sunshine, since you've had none up there for a while. Thank you very much. And I hope we will see you again at other sessions throughout the weekend, ladies and gentlemen.